Hello, it's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Darren Kelly's Good Life Farm was all hydroponics up until a year and a half ago.
Yeah, they don't want anything to do with the hydroponic system. And the hydroponics definitely don't want anything to do with the mushrooms. So, yeah, it's two separate areas on the farm. Very, very distinctly different.
Today, we talk about the difficulties of cultivating mushrooms. You can cultivate mushrooms on a very small scale. Daniel Orr shows off his method. We make a faux risotto with mushrooms also coming up. Then several of the biggest seed and chemical companies want to combine. Harvest Public Media looks at how they got to this point and why it matters. What's up with the week in food news? Here's Mark.
Annie, we record at Indiana University in Bloomington, so we like to keep an eye out for food stories from other college campuses. Recently, we heard this story from one of the most expensive schools in the country, George Washington University. Tuition at GW is $68,000 per year. Nearly half of its student body have experienced food insecurity, which matches the national rate of 48% of respondents. So the school opened a food pantry for students, joining over 300 other schools across the nation that have done the same. IU also has a food pantry for students. GW's food pantry is unmarked. Students fill out forms that list their email addresses and student ID numbers, but they don't have to give their names or discuss their finances. And as NPR reports, students are using it. In September, the university did a soft launch of the food pantry without any advertising, and 21 students signed up immediately. Now, 147 students are enrolled in the program. Things got heated over yogurt this week. Farm groups are calling Danone's pledge to reduce GMO ingredients, quote, flim-flam, that uses fear-based marketing and trendy buzzwords to boost sales. A letter to Danone CEO Mariano Lozano says the plan would, quote, force farmers to abandon safe, sustainable farming practices, unquote, and reverse gains in sustainability that the groups say GMO crops enable. The farm groups include the National Corn Growers Association, the American Farm Bureau Federation, and the American Soybean Association. In response to the letter, Danone released a statement calling the criticisms divisive and misinformed. The statement outlined farming goals the company considers sustainable without the use of GMO crops, including better soil and water quality, more biodiversity, and decreased emissions. The statement added that managing use of pesticides and herbicides is a major part of the company's plan. Danone released a line of non-GMO yogurts this summer. And harvest is underway on farms across the Midwest and Great Plains. But with prices in the tank for the region's most important crops, many farmers are just hoping to break even this year. The last time things looked so bleak for corn and wheat growers and cattle ranchers was during the 1980s farm crisis. Low crop prices and high debt resulted in a prolonged economic slump in farm country. Val Docini is in charge of the U.S. Department of Agriculture office that oversees farm loans. He says low interest rates and government-subsidized crop insurance are key to blunting the impact.
The great difference between what happened in the 1980s and what's happened today is that the safety net is that much more robust.
Tough times on the farm can have ripple effects across rural America. When farmers struggle, so do the makers of tractors and other farm equipment, and so do the small towns that service the farm economy. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Luke Runyon for these stories. We got even more at Earth Eats on Twitter.
And eartheats.org. Hope you'll come visit the website to see what other stories we're talking about. Mark Chilla, he's our news guy. Thanks.
Hey, no problem.
If you're interested in sustainable farming practices, you might look at the heart of the Kansas prairie. Nestled among acres of wheat fields and rows of corn, the Land Institute is a magnet for environmental activists. Now, after four decades developing alternative ways of raising grain, the leader and founder of the Land Institute is stepping down. But as Harvest Public Media's Frank Morris reports, the Institute's new leader says they're on the cusp of a breakthrough.
In an open pasture just south of Salina, Kansas, about three dozen people are out before dawn for a walk.
Well, we're from Seattle, and we're here because we're, you know, very inspired by the work that the Land Institute does. And I've never been to Kansas before, and it's much more beautiful than a lot of America thinks it is.
Amy Souza, like everybody else here, is here for the Land Institute's annual Prairie Festival. Jeffrey Funk drove straight from the Montana Rockies.
Land Institute is just a bit of a mecca for progressive ecological thinking.
We're all following David Van Task, plant scientist with a microphone.
Oh. When you look around, what do you see? What is it? How's it different than where we've been?
Van Tassel points out a boundary where an old farm field long ago seeded with native prairie plants meets virgin prairie. Grass and flowers reach about chest high on both sides, but the old growth prairie is clearly more dense and diverse. John Piper, a biology professor at Bethel College, says the real story is underground.
Even though that has been planted back to native vegetation some decades ago, it still looks very, very different because the soil has been changed. We may not know how long it takes for that soil to ever come back to its original form. Maybe it never will.
Traditional farming breaks up the soil, causes runoff, and depletes nutrients. For major crops, most farmers now practice what's called no-till farming. It saves them turning the soil every year, but requires lots of chemicals. So, can we find a new way of farming, one that mirrors natural, sustainable ecosystems and is still profitable for farmers? 40 years ago, the Land Institute set out to find an answer. Piper says researchers are trying to cultivate an agricultural system that works more like the prairie.
Oh.
It's right about here that David Van Tassel points out something called Canada wild rye.
It's a native perennial plant that we're looking at as a possible candidate for domestication.
The Land Institute has developed a perennial grain crop called Kernza. Scientists there are working on perennial sorghum, rice, and oilseed, too. What it doesn't have, after 40 years, is any kind of perennial crop that a farmer can make a living growing. Still, many, like Teresa Jones, a biologist from Massachusetts, say it seems like this institute is about to take off.
I mean, Land Institute was swimming upstream for a long time. But now I think it's right in the stream, and I think it's going to enable it to move forward with some of this both ecological and cultural transformation much more quickly, which makes me very optimistic.
We're in pretty good shape.
Wes Jackson is the original idea man at the Land Institute, and he ran it from its inception 40 years ago until the 1st of October. He says perennial agriculture seemed crazy to most people at first, but now it's gone global.
We're on five continents now, all the way from Sweden to Uganda, Australia to Canada, India.
It's the organization kind of graduating into full-fledged movement status. It's no longer just a lone voice in the wilderness, you know, no longer one man's big vision.
That's the new guy speaking.
Fred Utsi. I'm, according to my name tag, the incoming president of the Land Institute.
Utsi says the solid funding that Jackson has secured over the years is allowing the Land Institute to do fine-grain genetic research and crunch enormous amounts of data, which will accelerate new plant development. As the thousand or so people spilling out of a barn at this year's Prairie Festival heard over and over again, none of this is going to happen overnight. But after all, Wes Jackson says if you're working on something you can finish in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Another story from the Land Institute this week about the grain Kernza. They're breeding it and growing it and studying it. And now, a brewery is making a beer with it. That article is at eartheats.org. Big change could be coming to our food system. Today, six companies dominate the marketplace for seeds, pesticides, and fertilizers. And several major deals currently pending could cut that number in half. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer and Luke Runyon explain how we got here and why you should care.
Let's start right around World War II. Back then, we had hundreds of seed companies. If you could hear the marketplace, it'd be loud and chaotic.
Tons of different seed sellers.
States Hybrid Service.
Wartime innovations sparked the first era of a sea change in our food system.
Chemical breakthroughs and biological discoveries multiply production and improve quality.
Three key things came together. One, carefully bred proprietary seeds called hybrids.
Another, cheap synthetic fertilizer.
And finally, pesticides. Think of it as the holy trinity of modern agriculture.
These scientific breakthroughs grabbed the attention of large companies and ushered in our second wave of change. In the 60s, big business came calling on agriculture.
Pat Mooney is a researcher with the Canadian think tank Etc. Group. He says oil companies were early on the scene.
Standard Oil of New Jersey, which is now ExxonMobil, got into buying seed companies and looking at ways that they could use their fossil fuel industry interests, which is linked to, of course, fertilizers and pesticides as well, to become a one-stop retail shop.
Bigger footprints, control of distribution, putting seeds, fertilizer, and pesticides under one roof could lead to more profit.
At one time, Shell Oil was the world's largest seed company.
Agriculture enticed other big businesses, too. Chemical and pharmaceutical companies jumped in.
The pharmaceutical companies also had pesticide companies, and they could see the logic of moving into an industry which could let them take advantage of their pesticides and market their pesticides and their seeds together.
Unlike big oil, big pharma and some major chemical companies stuck around. At this point, our agricultural marketplace doesn't sound nearly as busy.
Upjohn Pharmaceutical.
Bayer.
Advanta.
Novartis.
Plus, in the 1980s, laws began changing in favor of big companies. Michigan State University sociologist Phil Howard studies corporate consolidation.
The antitrust laws were, kind of dramatically reinterpreted by federal agencies and federal judges in the U.S.
Small companies got gobbled up or struggled to survive. And Howard says it ushered in a new era where to succeed as a small business means to be bought by a bigger one.
Hell no, GMO! Hell no, GMO!
Finally, the third wave of change came 20 years ago with the introduction of genetically modified seeds. You probably know them as GMOs.
Genetic engineering transformed commercial farming. Companies like Monsanto and Syngenta created seeds that grow a whole lot more corn and soybeans.
But it took a lot of money to get there, and it put a bigger divide between the companies large enough to do that and all the rest.
Now, some of those leading agrochemical companies are proposing deals to get even bigger.
Chemical giant Dow wants to merge with DuPont. The German aspirin maker Bayer is trying to buy Monsanto, currently the world's largest seed company.
And a Chinese state-owned chemical company, ChemChina, wants to buy Syngenta, a Swiss seed and chemical business. If the deals currently in the works go through, the marketplace would be dominated by the three resulting firms, sounding something like this.
Dow DuPont.
Bayer Monsanto.
Syngenta ChemChina.
Dow DuPont.
Bayer Monsanto.
Syngenta ChemChina.
The companies say they can serve farmers better by being bigger.
Opponents say too much concentration means higher prices and less innovation.
And food activists already decry the size and influence of giants like Monsanto. I'm Amy Mayer.
And I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
More at harvestpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a single show. You can also listen to previous shows on our website, eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Daniel Orr is cooking with mushrooms, but first, he brought in something special to show off. It's a long shiitake log.
Yes, I actually have 60 of these at my cabin. So it's quite an impressive little fence row that goes down through one of my valleys. And in the base of that valley, I have about a foot of wood chips that have been inoculated with wine cap mushroom spores. And they're these giant mushrooms that are kind of like porcinis or ceps in French. Really, really tasty. And the nice thing about both the wine caps and the shiitakes is that they fruit twice a year. So you get a spring harvest and a kind of fall harvest. They like kind of warm days and cool nights. So that's when they come out. And I went out there the other day, and much to my surprise, I had these giant, giant shiitakes.
That's the size of your face. It's smiling at us. Look.
It's when they start to curl up like this, I mean, they're probably a little bit overgrown. They're still plenty edible, and I will use these. But if you look over here, these are about perfect. So these are this is the size that you really want to harvest. They have a better texture. They're a little bit tighter. They're less wet. There's less chance that they've had any bug or insect damage.
The perfect shiitakes are a little larger than silver dollars, the caps are. You can buy a shiitake log already inoculated, or you could do it yourself.
You want to use a log that hasn't, you know, that has been cut fresh and inoculate before. It has had the chance to get a lot of other fungus in it. And then what you do is you drill holes, and then you put in your shiitake sporum, and then it's sealed with a vegan wax, so this is a completely vegan product, and then you let it sit out and get wet and dry and wet and dry, and usually in about a year you get mushrooms. There are things you can do to speed up the process. You can soak the logs in water. You can also, if your logs are short, this one's about probably 3.5 feet long. If they're shorter, you can actually put them in a freezer to emulate the cold nights, and you can keep your mushroom patch going all year round.
Now, this isn't foolproof by any means. Dangerous mushrooms could attach to your log, so before you dig into this project, check out the how-to article we've posted on Twitter. Scroll down a bit in the feed at twitter.com/eartheats. Daniel is cultivating mushrooms just for fun, really. He could never grow enough to supply his restaurant. That's where Darren Kelly and Good Life Farms come in.
Hydroponics and mushroom farm. I can now say that. As about 5 months ago, I can say that, yeah.
They've been supplying Farm Bloomington with lettuce mix, arugula, and basil for 7 years. That's the restaurant's standard weekly order. Today, he's also brought creminis, portobellos, and white button mushrooms. Darren says they've expanded their operation to include mushrooms. They did that a year and a half ago, and it was tough from the very beginning.
Yeah, they don't want anything to do with the hydroponic system, and the hydroponics definitely don't want anything to do with the mushrooms. So, yeah, it's two separate areas on the farm, very, very distinctly different, very distinctly different methods of growing.
They pulled their first crop for customers in April. They started off by hiring a consultant to help them figure out how to grow mushrooms on their farm. Lesson number one, mushrooms are finicky. They dropped a bunch of money on equipment to keep the fungi happy.
Like CO2, air temperature, air movement, you know, they have to all be in insulated rooms. Everything needs a cooling unit. There's a lot to it, and there's about 20 steps to the process of getting it to the point of delivering something yummy to everyone.
Good Life Farms started their hydroponics operation 10 years ago. In those early days, Darren said they sold products in Terre Haute. They kept growing more and more greens, so that gave them the confidence to seek out additional customers.
It comes down to, I think, a matter of, do I have the product? And if I know I'm going to have excess product, I need to find a market for it. So, and then also, and that's how we ended up meeting Blooming Foods. Was just at some point about 7 or 8 years ago, we had extra product, and so I went and I contacted the produce manager over at Blooming Foods and said, "Hey, here's what I have. It's local. You want a sample? Show them what I have." They generally like it, I hope, and then we move on from there. With Lucky's, I knew that a new grocery store was coming in, and of course, as a business, we want to get in on the ground floor, so we contacted them before they even opened, and we had product on their shelves the day they opened.
These days, they supply 8 restaurants and a couple grocery stores. Before they took the plunge on starting the mushroom operation on the farm, they had to decide if their customer base was interested.
You know, we grew this product, and we knew from talking with our customers that they'd be very receptive to receiving this product. So it was a matter of trying to get good at it, which we're still working at.
So far, so good. They're selling something like 600 packages of mushrooms every week. That's in addition to the nearly 100,000 heads of greens that are harvested from the other part of Good Life Farms every year. So our recipe today uses some of Darren Kelly's cultivated mushrooms and some wild mushrooms Daniel found in his woods. It's a risotto, but we're using farro, not rice, so a faux risotto, I guess. Here it is. Shrooms.
And farro.
Which looks a lot like wheat berries.
That's because they are wheat berries.
Oh.
But they're special wheat berries. Okay. Farro is a Italian wheat. It's a little bit smaller than the typical wheat berries. They have a little reddish tinge to them. What we've done is we've cooked the farro in advance, and it takes about 45 to 50 minutes, just like the wheat berries. But with the farro, you don't want to rinse it off. You want to leave that kind of coating on it. And you can see that this cooked farro, it's starting to fall apart a little bit, where those wheat berries just stayed really nice and plump, almost like popcorn kernels.
That wheat berry recipe was from a couple weeks ago, and you can find that on our website, by the way. So our lineup of mushrooms is golden oysters, king oysters, chicken mushrooms, crominis, and hedgehog mushrooms.
Okay, so I'm just going to slice up these mushrooms. And I don't want to cut them up too fine because I want to be able to have the texture of the different mushrooms noticeable so I can really see what I'm eating and taste what I'm eating and feel what I'm eating.
Those hedgehogs, they were new to me. He said he looked out his window at the cabin the other day and saw a line of bright orange mushrooms in the woods. But he knew it was too late in the season for chanterelles, so Daniel did some research and he spoke with a mushroom expert to discover that he had hedgehog mushrooms on his hands. They not only look a little like chanterelles, they taste like them too.
With the hedgehog, what you want to do is just kind of scrape off the veils underneath. They're like these, almost like little sawdust. They come right off. Okay, and then you can put those spores back out into your garden or into your woods and encourage more mushrooms to come up next year. All right, so we got a nice hot pan on. Our farro's already cooked, so this is going to be a very quick dish to make. We're going to throw in our onions, which we diced fine. It's about an onion and a half or one extra large onion. I like to have quite a bit of onion in the risotto because it lightens the dish, makes it a little less starch heavy. Now I'm going to add my mushrooms. I'm still over high heat. I'm going to add my garlic. I've got about 4 cloves. Okay. White wine. Now, white wine has quite a bit of acidity to it. As you cook it, that acidity turns sweet, especially with the onions. All right, so the white wine is about reduced by half. Add our farro. And that starch from the exterior of the farro is going to blend with that white wine and kind of produce a sauce. Well, that continues to heat through. I'm going to add some seasoning. I've got my salt and pepper. Again, we're going to be adding some Parmesan cheese, which is very salty, so we don't want to add too much salt. Okay, we're going to add another of my Earth Eats favorite ingredients, the lemon zest. Again, the exterior of the lemon. We're going to finish it with some Parmesan cheese. I'm going to turn off the fire. You don't want, after you add the cheese, you don't want to heat the risotto anymore, because then the fat from the cheese will separate if it gets too hot, and you'll get a greasy product. Wish you guys could smell this. Okay, I might give it a little bit of a taste. Mmm. You gotta try this at home.
Finish this off with soft herbs and thyme and oregano and a sprinkle more Parmesan. Next week, we've been waiting and waiting to share Daniel's ratatouille recipe. And now that summer veggies have finally stopped producing, finally, it's a good time. All of our recipes are archived at eartheats.org. We have time for one more mushroom recipe. This one is as easy as it gets. It's from our archives featuring king oyster mushrooms.
But what they look like is an oyster mushroom on steroids. You know, I mean, they're giant. They've got this wonderful stem on them. They're meaty. So what I'm going to do with these is just cut them in half, leave them. I mean, they're so dramatic looking that I'm going to leave them really nice and big and chunky, and have a real simple presentation. A little bit of olive oil on top, just enough to lightly coat them. All right, then we got salt and pepper. I'm gonna put them on a roasting pan and throw them up under the broiler. And that is it.
That's it?
Yeah, and that will take probably about 3 to 5 minutes under the broiler.
So you're treating these like a main course then?
Yeah, this would be, they're almost like a steak. They're so meaty. You could do, if you can't find the king mushrooms, you could use portobello mushrooms a lot the same way. Even in the time when chanterelles are around, you could do the same recipe with chanterelles. All right, so we pull these out of the broiler. You can see they're nicely browned. That kosher salt's kind of crunchy on top of them. We're going to take a half lemon, just squeeze a little bit of that on top. Okay, a little touch of truffle oil. Okay, and here I've got a nice Napa cabbage leaf. Okay, we're gonna put 3 of these mushrooms on top of the Napa cabbage. And one of the nice things about this is I have some spinach arugula pesto. I put that on that Napa leaf. It gives a little bed of sauce underneath there. It plays off the green colors in the Napa. It's a little darker, more kind of gutsy green with that pureed spinach, Parmesan cheese, and arugula with a little bit of garlic, salt, and pepper. And we're gonna call that a day. Nice, simple presentation. You know, lovely as an appetizer. You could add a couple other things to make it a main course, maybe some rice, some wild rice, some different mixed grains, and you'd have a wonderful vegetarian dish.
No meat necessary. You got hen of the woods mushrooms? We have a recipe for that too at eartheats.org. Shout outs to the reporters at Harvest Public Media: Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, and Daniel Orr. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location available at whereisurgent.com. And of course, a big thanks to the listeners who also support Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Till next time.